So I guess because Playing God was such a rounding success, they gave us another Dax episode only two episodes later.
Yeah, and a Dax Klingon episode at that.
Yeah, and there's a very interesting trivia tidbit about those three Klingon characters, which I don't think you have any idea about.
No, I try. You said, you know, do you know who those Klingons are when we were watching it? And I'm like, I have no idea. So I'm trying to rack my brain. Were they in, you know, the original series? Were they in like Star Trek VI or something like that? But I don't know.
Well, I will tell you, but when we're done talking about the episode, because I don't want it to color your opinion of Blood Oath. Oh, what did you think about it?
Oh, Blood Oath. Well, here's the thing. I normally like Klingon episodes. I didn't like this episode.
Yeah, it's very unsuccessful.
It's very boring. I mean, it should be... This is an episode that has a lot of kind of meat in the premise that they don't really know what to do with. You know, we were talking, I guess it was last week, about, you know, whether or not Terry Farrell did the best, you know, job with this or not. And in this episode, it doesn't, you know, it just feels like she's kind of going along with this because that's where she's going along with. And in a way, you know, they don't seem to realize where the interest in Dax's conflict comes from. This is, in a way, I mean, this is almost like picking up a family's, you know, family member's dream. You know, this is like, you know, she's avenging her father's death to a degree, symbolically, in this episode. You know, she is trying to, you know, do somebody that she has a close bond with, you know, fulfill one of their life ambitions. And whether or not, you know, and this is something which goes against, you know, everything that she is and everything that everybody expects her to be. At the end, when, you know, they see her having gone on the mission, they all, you know, give her that, you know, weird look at the very end. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable ending, but I don't.
Is it, though? Because I don't necessarily think that it does go against what Dax is for, because, you know, we spent a lot of time talking last week about Playing God and about, you know, what is the relationship between the symbiont and the actual humanoid person? You know, what is their personality? What kind of, even to the degree about, you know, what responsibilities do they have to people that were in their life previously? And, you know, this show seems to, I think, try to have it both ways, at least to some degree. I think that, you know, as Trill develops, I think it'll be interesting to see if they come up with, you know, rules for, you know, what the Trill are supposed to do. You know, there's a lot of stuff here that is rife for exploration. But I think that, you know, the relationship that Jadzia Dax has to Sisko, for example, seems to align strongly with the idea that she does, you know, that symbionts do have
A continuity
and a responsibility to their previous selves. Now, of course, they do explicitly say in this episode that Trill symbionts are in no way obligated to fulfill those, you know, responsibilities of previous hosts.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean that Jadzia Dax as a person doesn't feel responsible. And indeed, she does.
Yeah. I mean, the relationship with Sisko, for example, and as we saw a little bit more in season one, got off to a rocky start, you know, because there was this change in Dax. But at this point, they seem to have reestablished an equilibrium. And there is something, you know, that's not so much, you know, maybe the original friendship came from Curzon. But at this point, Jadzia herself has managed to find things in Sisko that, you know, she, you know, qualities that she admires, you know, and wants to be friends with, you know. So, you know, in this case, in a way, it's almost a case of hearing Curzon tell this story about this godson that he lost, that, you know, Jadzia herself, you know, has felt begun to feel a love for him, and, you know, a sense of injustice at this loss, at what happened, and at the fact that there is somebody who is a very bad guy who is just out there, you know. And
you know, I think really the problem is, though, that Terry Farrell just isn't up to the task here. I mean, I'm really trying to be charitable, but she's one of the weaker actors that I think have been a main character in a Star Trek series to this point. I
think it's fair.
It would be it would be phoning it in, but she's not phoning it in. Like, it's that bad in this episode. She seems unaware of the emotional weight of what's going on. Because I think that the writing in this episode is fine. I think that the performances of the three Klingons is fine and effective. You know, I think everything that's going on, it could be very interesting. But the problem with Blood Oath at its center is it is relying on the acting abilities of Terry Farrell, and frankly, she can't pull it off.
Well, that's, you know, one of the things that I'm starting to realize is that Trill is a combination of a lot of different, you know, in a way I have to think of it almost as an id ego, super ego kind of, you know, these different drives within, you know, the self, you know, because, you know, in the character that we call Dax, you have the woman Jadzia, you have the symbiote Dax, you have their, you know, joined version Jadzia Dax, you have this memory of Curzon Dax, you have, you know, these even, you know, more back, you know, incarnations in a way. And so, yes, you have all of these forces conflicting within, you know, this one being. And, you know, I can see the Trill being a very interesting existence, whether or not all the different personalities are, you know, fighting for supremacy, because she talks about, you know, oh, you have to balance out the symbiote's, you know, desires and wishes, and, you know, this may be a case where the symbiote's wishes are a little more prevalent than perhaps Jadzia herself's, but at this point you can also, it also comes, you know, off almost as if, you know, if Jadzia recognized that the symbiote's wish is going to be a lot stronger, she'll let it, you know, kind of drive for a little bit.
Well, yeah, because I don't get the impression that Jadzia would allow the symbiote to make her do things that she doesn't want to do. And there's no indication really that the symbiote could do that.
No, but it's more like again, there's a lot where, you know, you can think of it in terms of a relationship. You know, you and, you know, another person may have a specific dream that's not really yours, but you recognize that, no, you know, this is what we're going to do right now.
Yeah, like my dog has a specific dream about pooping outside, and I don't, and I allow him to do it. So
yeah, so at this point, Dax wants to poop outside, and Jadzia says, well, look, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, I just, you know.
But she doesn't make that clear. Do you know what you mean?
Well, because she's not up to the task. I mean, frankly, she's just not up to the task. I think that, you know, it's interesting to me, because after we had the conversation last week about Jadzia and about, you know, where they were taking the character and sort of turning her into this bon vivant character, very lively, and very sort of worldly, and, you know, Terry Farrell just not being able to pull that off. And the interesting thing is, all of the background that I found out about this kind of character shift is that they were retooling the character of Dax to more fit Terry Farrell's personality.
Huh.
And, you know, I don't have anything. I love Terry Farrell. I think that she's, you know, I've seen her at conventions a couple of times. She's fantastic on stage. She's very lively. You know, she really loves being with the fans. You know, she dresses up. I mean, you know, she allowed them to make her up as Dax a couple years ago. Right. You know, she came out in an old Dax costume. You know, all these kind of things. She really likes doing this stuff.
There isn't that sense of fun and reckless abandonment in the character.
Right. And frankly, I mean, you know, you can make arguments that a lot of the Star Trek actors don't really have careers after this because they're kind of typecast. I think sometimes they're just, you know, all right, they're not great. I kind of feel like in Terry Farrell's case, it's probably because she's just not that good.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I really hate to say that. I'm not trying to be rude or mean. I just think it's a problem with the show. And I think it's incumbent on us, you know, as critics of this franchise to, you know, call a spade and say,
well, I guess
her acting abilities are a problem and they are dragging episodes down.
Hmm. I mean, I know, you know, we have occasionally compared her more briefly to like Spock or, you know, Data, but I can see her playing a Vulcan much better than that. I can see her playing an android type character better than what they are making Dax.
You know, I disagree with you, because I think that there's a lot more subtlety involved in playing a Vulcan than is necessarily understood. I mean, you know, Leonard Nimoy's portrayal of Spock certainly is emotionless, but it's not flat. It's not, you know, he allows himself to have a lot of subtle, you know, character moments and a lot of, you know, movement of face and all kinds of, you know, motions and things like that, you know, inflection. Well, and you know, that's exactly the kind of problem with an actor who is playing a Vulcan who says, they're just unemotional. Like, I actually think...
Well, no, it's not, because I don't think of, you know, Tari Farrell as performing unemotional. She does... I mean, I would say she's more cool and relaxed in a way. Like, you know, she... And, you know, I guess, I'm thinking she could play a version of Vulcans that, you know, is not really bothered by things because, you know, just needs to look logically at the situation, you know, and things will be fine. And, you know, the way of mastering the emotions is to, you know, not worry and just like, you know, she could do that version of a Vulcan, I think, very well.
Well, frankly, I maybe, you know, I don't know. But I think that...
But,
that...
yeah, she can't play this. Again, Dax, you know, Dax is almost a Luoxana Troi character in the way they're trying to make her.
Yeah.
And Tari Farrell is not that out there. You know, she is a little too restrained in her performance.
Yeah, but I think that there's supposed to be a dignity to the way that Dax is as opposed to Luoxana Troi.
Of course.
You know, I think that what it really comes down to is, you know, there's a story about when they cast Tari Farrell and the reason why they changed the Trill makeup, because of course the Trill were introduced in an episode of TNG.
Yeah.
And if you remember, the Trill looked very different. They had, you know, typical Star Trek face stuff going on. And when they cast Tari Farrell, this beautiful woman, they didn't want to do that to her. And so that's where they came up with the idea of the spots. Now, you know, I'm not saying that they're necessarily hiring actors based on looks. Of course, this is Hollywood. This is American television. And so, of course, they are going to necessarily want some eye candy for the demographics that they want to attract. But I kind of wish that they had maybe picked a pretty actress who also could actually act.
Well, I mean, you know, let's put it this way. Kira's actress is, you know, very pretty, and she can certainly act. You know, you have any of the women on, you know, TNG were able to act. You know, that's a... Yeah, I think that only goes so far. It's true.
I mean, I don't know. Am I being too harsh on Tari Farrell? I mean, you know, this is your first time watching the show, so...
You know, I wouldn't say she's a bad actress. And I think the fact that we're so... Because my impression of Dax episodes does tend to go down the more that we talk, you know, as we talk about them.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, normally I find myself, you know, usually liking, you know, and I like when Dax is on screen. I think she's a very interesting character. I like the, you know, I always like when you have a weird alien species and let's go into how a differing physiology, you know, brings out about a very different culture. You know, what is, you know, I am very interested in, all right, the Trill are able to do, you know, to do this, you know, thing with the symbiote. You know, what does that mean? How is their society structured around that? I think is interesting. But yeah, talking about it, and if I were just watching this to watch the show, if this was 1993 and I was, you know, watching DS9, none of this would come up. No, you know, her performance is fine on the surface, but there isn't much depth to, in a way, you know, there isn't much there. And so I think we just usually end up in nitpicking when we talk about that.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know that it's nitpicking. I mean, I do think that it's a fundamental problem with the character. And, you know,
I guess, yeah, it's making it clear that there is a great amount of what could have been.
Yeah, and, you know, I think to some degree I agree with you that you know, if you're just watching this for total entertainment value in 1994, you may not necessarily notice this. But I think at the same time, I mean, A, we're not doing that, right?
Yeah.
And so, B, I think also that you know, if you're watching this purely for entertainment value, it may not bother you as much. But, you know, at least for my part, I watch something for entertainment value and I still notice when things are not great in it. You know, and it does color my enjoyment or not of particular episodes or particular movies.
Yeah.
So
I think we've made it, you know, I think our general feeling is that if she had been played by a different actress who was better at, you know, making, you know, grounding the character in that conflict, in being able to have that earth, you know, embody that earthiness a little bit, maybe it would be a better show. Maybe those episodes would be better, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I like the way that, you know, Tari Farrell's chemistry with Nana Visitor is very good, and I like when they have a scene together. And I think her with all of the different, you know, her chemistry is very good. Maybe it's when she's just with a guest actor or doing something on her own. But when, you know, when she's a minor character and she's bouncing off of someone else who's better than her, frankly, as an actress, she does a very good job.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do agree with you with that. And I was going to say that I think that Terry Farrell works really well on the show in small doses, or when she's in the background, or when she's just having a fun, you know, scene with Kira or Sisko, yeah, or whoever, or Quark, for example. You know, I think that those scenes work very well. I don't know that she can carry an entire episode by herself. And I think that, you know, we certainly, I think early on, you know, Dax and Invasive Procedures both suffered because they sidelined Dax in her own episode and really made it an episode about Dax. And she just wasn't an entity. She wasn't an actor in her own episode.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, playing God and Blood Oath very much are Dax episodes, and she is very much an actor at the center of them.
Yeah, they center around her decisions and her personality and what she's doing. Yeah.
But they still fail. And so I think that a lot of that has to be laid at her feet. You know, I don't want to keep browbeating this point, but I do think that Blood Oath would have worked a lot better with a different person playing Dax.
No, again, we talked a little bit last week about, like, Troy. And, yeah, there were so many bad Troy episodes and bad Dr. Crusher episodes, but when you had a Face of the Enemy, or, you know, the one with the sun armor plating stuff, you know, those were really good episodes. We've had several opportunities.
Which one?
The one with Dr. Crusher, where the Ferengi scientist. And
oh, yeah, that one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I guess that was a fair criticism for the, you know, for Dax, for the
invasive procedures.
For invasive procedures. Yeah. But at this point, we can't make that as a criticism of that. That's not the problem with Blood Oath. It's not the writing.
No, it's not. Absolutely.
Although I would say, I mean, and, you know, I think we need to climb out of this rabbit hole. But...
Well, no, I was about to transition into the actual episode, because I think that, you know, the other problem with the episode, of course, is that while the writing is good and I think that the story is well told, I don't know that the story is one that's worth telling.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's about three guest stars that we don't really have any knowledge of and don't. Well, I do, but, you know, you don't. And I think, well, number one, I think that it is, you know, I don't want to keep dancing around this point, because I think that it's going to be difficult to talk about the episode in the way that I want to talk about it if I don't tell you who they are.
Yeah, who are they?
So they're Kang, Kor, and Koloth from the original series.
Okay. Okay.
And so Koloth is from The Trouble with Tribbles. Kor is from Errand of Mercy, and Kang is from Day of the Dove. They're the original actors. They're playing the same parts.
Okay.
Pretty much.
I know they made some very, you know, light reference, and I got the sense that, you know, if it was from TOS era, it would be just such a arcane reference that I wouldn't really get it, but...
They play it very close to the vest. I think a lot of the reason why nobody... I mean, you know, it's easy to overlook that point because, number one, they're actors in a tremendous amount of makeup that,
yeah,
we have never really seen in that kind of makeup before, so it hides a lot of their features. You know, I think that the other thing, of course, is... I don't think that you liked the original series that much, so I don't think that you really remember, you know, to that degree.
And I didn't really, because they barely developed Klingons as well on the original series.
It's, yeah.
You know, especially compared to where they went. So.
But I think if, you know, Mudd came back,
no,
remember him. So I think that they're,
yeah,
you know,
that it is fair. They were, you know, Klingons were for the most part generic villains for a lot of the way they were, you know.
Yeah. But I don't think that it really matters, because they don't do anything with that information. And in fact, the episode was originally written with three Klingons that had nothing to do with those characters. They were three Klingons that never appeared in Star Trek before. And I forget who it was, but someone on the writing staff was a big TOS fan and said, hey, wouldn't it be funny if, you know, these were, or wouldn't it be cool,
you
if
know,
these were three Klingons from the original series? You know, they,
yeah,
called up their, they called up their agents or whoever and were like, hey, are they still acting? They were all still acting. They were all game to do it. And so they came back and did it.
It's
you
an
know,
Easter egg, you know.
Well, that's pretty much what it is. I think it works on that level. It's fine. You know, if you're watching this show and you're an original series fan and you go, oh my God, that's so cool. It's Koloth and The Trouble with Tribbles. Isn't that funny? You know, that's great. And I think that but it doesn't impact the episode in any way.
No, it helps ground them in who they say they are, which are, you know, we know that these are very, you know, high prestige, you know, warriors who have been around for, you know, as many years as anything, you know, and this is, you know, three old men into the, you know, into the battlefield. It also helps ground really Curzon's time a little bit more, knowing that, because, you know, now we really, you know, so, I mean, he was obviously, you know, not around during quite the original series, but a little past that, you know, maybe right past when the Star Trek VI, you know, I would assume is when he was born. So, you know, that you know, grounds the fact that he has relationships with Klingons in a very different light, which also makes, you know, one recognize that, you know, Jadzia has relationships with a lot of Ferengi, you know, and so that, you know, that almost implies that, you know, that's a character note of just Dax the symbiont in a way, you know, kind of the first one to, you know, hang out with, you know, the new players in the galaxy.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, nobody else likes them, but, you know, I'm going to figure out how to have a lot of fun with them.
Yeah. And I think that you know, that's fine. But
yeah,
I don't know if it's enough to sustain an entire episode. And, you know,
yeah, it's true. It makes the scene when she's at the restaurant singing with the restaurateur. But again, it's just a little, you know, it's just a little note about Dax.
Yeah, it gives a little backstory, it gives a little flavor to our character, but it doesn't really add anything, you know. And then you have sort of the central, you know, conceit of the episode, which is this whole idea that there's the albino, which is, I don't know, it's weird, and it's sort of like a Bond thing.
Bizarre.
Nobody cares.
He wasn't that interesting as...
He killed people that we didn't know and owe their children, and that's a shortcut for trying to get us to care because killing children is horrible. And, you know, and it's just...
You wanted him to be a Bond villain, I mean, he wasn't over the top. He wasn't, you know, charismatic. You know, I can barely remember what he looked like. I think he had a beard, you know?
Right.
And...
he was an albino.
Okay, good for him, but, you know, he, that doesn't mean that he can't act, you know. It was the plot, you know, wasn't really interesting, and while, of course, the meat of that story is Dax's decision, this, you know, these three people, their last, you know, moment of glory, it's about how to die as a Klingon, and all that stuff is great, but... why can't you show me a campy Bond villain too?
Yeah. There's one other thing that I want to talk about, which is the scene between Kira and Dax, where...
okay.
That's a good scene. And I think that if the episode had had more of that, had grounded it more in some sort of reality, frankly,
yeah,
I think it would have been a lot better. I think that, you know... Kira and Dax, I think that scene works, number one, because it's very well acted by both of them. And I know I just spent, you know, we just spent 10 minutes at the beginning of this episode talking about how Terry Fowle can't act, but it's
not
true.
But then we also said that she and, you know, Nate
right.
Visitor have very good chemistry and, you know, I like all their scenes, but...
you know, so it's grounded in the fact that they've developed this relationship over the past, you know, two seasons. So it works on that level. I don't think that this would have been a scene that they could have done in episode 3 or 4. And also, it frankly is, it's a very, very dark scene for this episode, because this episode does come across as comedic a lot of the time. Drunk Klingons and, you know, Koloth with his Brooklyn accent. You know, I mean, it's kind of funny. But, you know, it takes this moment very seriously. And so when Jadzia Dax is thinking about actually helping them murder somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, let's not beat around the bush. Kira is the person who knows what it means to kill someone and is very against it. So,
And I would even go further and say assassinate someone, because that, you know, is more likely what Kira did and more likely what, you know, Jadzia was doing. It's, you know, that is a very, and in a way that, as you said, grounds it in the reality. You know, we don't really, up until that point, this is a situation where the fact that she is going to take a life is really glossed over until that kind of conversation.
Right.
Beforehand, it's just a usual, we're going to defeat the bad guy, you know? And it does, when you're sitting around drinking with your Klingon buddies and talking about avenging your godson, you know, and we're going to get that guy that, you know, slipped out of her grasp. You know, that's all fun. That's big. That's legends. That's drama. That's the stuff of Klingons. But, you know, and as... Klingon, as you know, as adoptively Klingon as Dax may have been, Dax is not a Klingon, and Dax has not been, you know, had that, you know, blood initiation of the Klingons. You know, the, for the Klingons to talk about killing is different than any version of Dax to talk about killing. Culturally, it has a very different significance.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that you know, it's the Klingon stuff is you know, whatever. I mean, by this point, it's very paint by numbers, and I think that I could probably write a Klingon episode in my sleep. It wouldn't Ooh. Be very good, but I could do it. You know, and
The Sleep of Honor by Eric Brazier.
I think that's, again, why the Dax and Kira scene work so well, because it does kind of take that Klingon stuff and actually extrapolate it out a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, but aside from that, it's a very slight episode that could have been something that was very, very meaningful. You know, we just don't really learn that much about anybody.
Yeah.
And it's not entertaining. You know, it's for an episode that is, I think, trying to be fun and serious, it's kind of neither. And it's unfortunate, you know, because I also think that, you know, like, as a Star Trek fan, I think it's cool to see these Klingons again, and they don't do anything with them, really.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if they should have played it up a little more. I don't know. But at the end of the day, it just all kinds of come. This episode just really comes across as kind of like a so what.
Yeah, it has all the notes. This is a case where it has all the notes right, but it's just not playing the music in this one. And I'm not sure if we can pinpoint exactly why it doesn't work, but I don't think this episode quite worked. It's just slightly off key.
I think we did a pretty good job.
Good for us!
Let's talk about the Maquis Part 1.
Okay, so a quick question that I have. Compared to this
episode... I may have an answer.
Okay, so the episode of Next Generation where they go to the Native American Indian planet and, you know, they're trying to... when was that in relation to this episode?
It was before it.
Okay.
I believe.
How long have they been planning out this arc? Because especially, you know, this is an episode where I kind of know where it's going to go based on the fact that I've seen, you know, Ensign Rose last episode.
Yeah.
I kind of knew what the Maquis is. This is filling in the details of that, but... it's very interesting to see that this is, you know, to see this as the inevitable result of some consequences. Again, we saw firsthand how the Federation handled telling people from, you know, different colonies, look, you gotta get out of here. The Cardassians have this planet now. We see how, in a way, poorly they handled that, and how that was a very, you know, how nobody was really happy with this. And this is an episode about the direct consequences of that. You know, I've always really liked Star Trek when it deals with the consequences of, you know, a decision that seemed right at the time, but was not done with the long term, you know, with the long term in mind. That's frankly the reason that Wrath of Khan is such a great, you know, movie. But I really like this, I like this arc. This is the, first of all, this is the, feels like the show going, giving us a real episode finally.
Yeah, I think that the, you know, the last part of the second season of DS9 is quite a bit better than the rest of it. And, you know, this is kind of the beginning of that. You know, the Maquis Part 1, I think, is a fine episode. I think that you know, it's interesting, it's fun to watch, whatever. But, you know, is it revelatory? I don't know. But I do think that it's interesting that you frame it as following up on something that happened before. Because, you know, I don't know that following up with direct consequences to a decision made is something that Star Trek does a lot. And, you know, I think that you're starting to see that Deep Space Nine is going to be the Star Trek show that does a lot of that. Because the difference, of course, and we haven't really talked about this, is that it takes place on a stationary space station.
Yeah.
And they can't leave. You know, so there's always the thing about, you know, Star Trek, the original series, and The Next Generation, where they could do something. Maybe it was a good idea. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it would completely fix problems. Maybe it wouldn't. But it didn't really matter because they were leaving and they had to, you know, other people were going to deal with the consequences. Deep Space Nine is, the place where consequences have to be dealt with. And I don't know that they're necessarily ready for that.
The series is, yeah. I
No. I mean, actually, Deep Space Nine, the characters, the not characters. The show. The show, well, the show is ready for it.
I mean, I think maybe this isn't a revelatory episode in light of stuff that happens later. Again, even just having seen that final Ensign Row episode where, you know, she joins the Maquis and, you know, we've understood what they were. But, you know, this isn't something, you know, it isn't like we've heard, you know, we heard the names like the Circle a couple times before, you know, we learned what that was. We heard the Dominion a couple times. You know, we haven't heard the name Maquis. Maybe that's, you know, maybe it would have been a little effective if they'd seeded that a little quicker. You know, a little more, you know, just once or twice even, you know, let us wonder, well, what does that mean? And, you know, finally, but
I don't know, I think that I disagree with you, actually, because I think that it does work in the episode. You know,
it does seemingly come out of nowhere. And
this is the origin story of a terrorist group.
OK.
Or is it? Mm. I mean, that's the question, right? And, you know, to answer your question, I never did answer your question. I don't know how long they were planning this out for.
Yeah.
I assume that they had this in mind, you know, during the 1993-1994 television season, and they were working on it. You know, I mean, it's not like the two writing staffs weren't talking to each other.
No, I know.
But, you know, so Journey's End is the first kind of gauntlet thrown, right? And then the Maquis Part 1 and Part 2 obviously are going to be following up on those events, right?
Yeah.
The Cardassian Federation colony trade.
I mean, I very specifically saw that at one point in, you know, the Maquis Part 1. There is a guy who is, you know, wearing, you know, feathers and leather. And, you know, it is directly reminding us of that episode.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he's not in the Eagle on a Saturday night.
Maybe he is.
I don't know. But I wonder, though, if – I don't know. This episode to me is really important because it kind of feels like Deep Space Nine becoming Deep Space Nine. Gul Dukat is at his most oily and obsequious, you know.
I love Gul Dukat, I think.
Okay. Why?
I don't know. I just think he's really, partially, I think the actor, you know, nails it and, you know, gets that. I really like the fact that to a degree you can trust him and you can't trust him at all. Like, and he, whenever Gul Dukat seems to say like, look, you know, we both have the same goal on this, you know, and the only way we can get this done is by helping each other out. He's not lying about that. He has looked through every option, and he thinks that you two really can get this done the most effectively. By working with him, you will get your goal. He will not double-cross you at the last second. You also know, of course, that he's also going to get 6 more things than you get on that, and they're all going to help Cardassian, maybe bring you a step back. But he's going to help you. It is like making a deal with the devil in a way. And
yeah.
You know, I like that Sisko doesn't trust him at all. I think Sisko can trust him a little bit more than he does. But again, I don't think you can trust Gul Dukat at all.
I don't know if I go that far. But yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that I like your reading of Gul Dukat. I think the listeners will like your reading of Gul Dukat.
You know, I
think it's interesting because Gul Dukat is one of those characters that, you know, you talk about how you like to see things that are threaded through episodes before. And I think Gul Dukat was one of those characters. You know,
yeah.
I think this is Gul Dukat stepping in the spotlight and saying, hey, this is me and this is what I'm about. And I'm going to be an important character in this show. Like, you know, I mentioned you thought the guy from like an episode ago was Gul Dukat and it was not Gul Dukat. I mean, I don't think that you really had a good conception in your mind of what the fuck Gul Dukat was until this episode.
A little bit in Necessary Evil. That is an earlier example of, again, Gul Dukat manipulating someone into helping him. They both get their goals done, but he gets more, you know.
Yeah.
That was an exact example of, you know, Odo getting exactly what he wished for and it not being a good thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't think that you would have thought that that character was Garrick or something. I mean, I think that, you know, he didn't really crystallize in your mind probably until this episode.
That's fair.
I mean, you know, frankly, is Gul Dukat lying? Is Gul Dukat not lying? I mean, you know, does he really have 7 children? You know, like he could be lying. I think that, you know, from everything that we've seen, I mean, I think about something like Chain of Command, right, from TNG, and how, you know, I sort of was under the assumption that the guy was lying and that that was not his daughter. Who knows what is actually true, what's not true. You know, I think the Cardassians are people that will lie to get what they want, and it doesn't really matter if it's true or not as long as it gets them what they want. You know, I think Garrick is a character that very much is like that, in that vein. And I think that Gul Dukat is in that vein as well. You know, I think that you know, Gul Dukat is very good at observation of people, and he's very good at reading people. And when Sisko mentions his son, he immediately goes, oh, this is something I can use.
Because the one with the Cardassian, you know, who is adopted by Bajorans, you know, they talk about family as being important to Cardassians. You know, is that legitimate? Again, is that something that I can take at face value or not? Because, it is, because yes, if family is as important as that, then, to say to Gul Dukat that he's worried he's going to kidnap Jake is an offensive thing, because, you know, that's almost beyond the pale. That's not a fair tactic, you know. But or is that just a pretense that the Cardassians have up just to, you know?
Well, the thing about the Cardassians is that, you know, the family stuff is really interesting, because I think that it's a cliche.
Yes.
You know, number one, it's like, oh, family is important. Wow.
It's a mafia, story. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But it's, you know, it's also like, who doesn't fucking, you know, think their family is important? I mean, you know. So that's kind of, you know, the subtext there, where it's very, very cliche, and you're very like, okay, this is not that interesting.
Yeah, I guess to a good degree, I guess it doesn't matter, because, you know, and that's really how I guess when one is dealing with a Cardassian, what do? You suspect every single thing that they're saying and miss some important truths? Because yes, the Cardassians aren't going to lie with every single sentence they do, and it is true that, you know, when your goals do coincide, they are very powerful.
But
at the same time, you know, you can't, I guess what Sisko does is he just tries to put every single possible defense. He's trying to go along for the ride and just minimize the collateral damage.
Well, the Cardassians and Gul Dukat especially are good at gaslighting people.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's really interesting, because I don't know that we've really seen that before in Star Trek. You know, I don't know that we can believe what they say. I think that you know, it is patently obvious that Gul Dukat should not be breaking into Sisko's quarters.
And no.
It's wrong that he's doing that. And of course, Sisko is right to not trust him. I don't think that Gul Dukat has ever shown himself to be someone who's trustworthy.
No.
But he's very good at playing the aggrieved party. And he's like, you know, what? Break into your quarter? What are you talking about, Jake? I don't even know who Jake is. You know, it's like that.
I guess
kind of
that's
thing.
Why I like him, because he is evil, but I don't hate. You know, like he is ridiculously charismatic. He's one of those characters that, yeah, you can't trust, but you can't hate, and which is you know, part of why he's such a dangerous person.
Oh, course. Absolutely, yeah, and you know, he's very integral to the whole plot. I think that. You know, moving aside from that for a minute, I think that one of the other interesting things about the Maquis Part One is how it sort of starts to question the Federation a little bit. And
yeah.
Kira openly saying she thinks the Federation is naive.
Yeah,
you know,
and Sisko himself comes off as kind of naive in a few spots in this episode.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Federation, you know, I don't know, Deep Space Nine is definitely, I've said this before, but I think that you know, it's kind of the closest in tone and spirit to the original series, I think. You know, the people are flawed. There's definitely an air that the galaxy is more dangerous than the Next Generation, certainly.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot more color and personality in the show than the Next Generation. You know, obviously, we both liked the Next Generation.
Yeah.
I think the Next Generation is a fine television show. And if you would like to hear our thoughts on it, there are
400
episodes where we talk about it. But it is the Star Trek show that is trying to make itself a different thing than the Next
yeah.
Generation. And I think the way that they're doing that is by starting to sort of raise a lot of the questions that are implicit in the premise of the franchise, in a way.
Well, you know, it's funny because partially this episode is reminding me a lot of that episode where Kira goes in. You know, the old man that they're going to turn the moon into a, you know, they're going to mine it for fuel or whatever.
Yeah.
Progress,
I think.
Yeah. Like, Sisko, doesn't really understand that Kira, you know, why Kira is helping him completely, you know, and, they don't seem to understand why people would want to stay there. That has been a blind spot in the Federation the whole time. And most of the characters that we've had in the Federation, more so in original series and Next Generation, but Sisko does still have a bit of this, people want to go out and see the galaxy more, and they don't really have a sense of staying home, you know? Picard, you know, what if Picard's major angst was the fact that he left home, you know, but, you know, and he didn't really look back, but every so often would be tempted by the comforts of home, but would realize that the career in Starfleet and the adventure was the... So this concept that, you know, you spent your lifetime, you know, farming this land, and now it's a part of it, and there's no... And you would rather live with Cardassians than give it up. That's something the Federation, you know... That makes no sense to the Federation.
Well, I think, yeah, I think you're right. And I think to take it further, I think that you know, like we saw from a couple episodes ago, I forget what the episode was called now, it's escaping my mind, but, you know, with the evil crazy lady and the planet, and, you know, it's...
Alexis,
yeah, that Paradise. Episode, Paradise, that... There is a division between the rank and file Starfleet and the Federation civilians, right? And I think that, you know, Starfleet has always been the focal point of the franchise. It is the way that we are told to the show is from the point of Starfleet more than it is, I think, from the point of the Federation. And Starfleet is definitely part of the Federation. They are answerable to the civilian government, but at the same time, they have their own things going on. Now, of course, they are still Federation citizens. You know, they still ostensibly believe in all the things that the Federation believes in. You know, this is kind of an aside, but one of the Star Trek novels that I just finished reading called Articles of the Federation, which was about the year in the life of the Federation president and some scandals and things like that. I think while it was an entertaining novel, I think that it did go a little too far in turning the Federation into a 20th or 21st century Western parliamentary democracy to a large degree, where, you know, they were doing things because it was convenient for them and not necessarily because it was the right thing to do. And so I think it's going a little too far down that road. I think that, you know, in this episode, what we start to see is that Starfleet is kind of, or maybe even the Federation, I don't know. You know, it's ambiguous. I think that we keep saying Starfleet because the show is from Starfleet's perspective. But I think that it's fair to say that it is the Federation because they're getting their orders from the Federation. And, you know, they are ostensibly in service to the Federation, and they are out there, you know, raising the flag for the Federation all the time. That the Federation is a very top-down sort of centralist entity. And they don't really understand that, oh, well, you could just move to another planet. You know, like they don't really get that, you know. And so in this episode, and I think in the previous one, you start to see that the Federation is almost at odds with its citizens, or at least some of them.
Well,
and that's uncomfortable.
You know, like it definitely there definitely is the I'm thinking back to Tasha Yar's rape gangs, you know, on her, you know, colony, where like the life on the colonies is horrible, you know, and you know, that's always been a weird thing in the series, given that, you know, they have a machine that literally makes food, you know, out of thin air, you know, that they can replicate anything they need. Like this should be a post-scarcity world. Why do we still have, you know, these implications of major scarcity? And you know, there are, you know, it seems like there are a lot of situations in which, you know, the Federation almost, the colonies almost seem kind of excommunicated by the Federation in this way.
Yeah, it's almost as though the Federation says, you don't want us, you really don't want us. We're gonna stay away. You know, we got a really good comment on Sanctuary from Jonas Karatsis, who Richard and I both know a little bit. And
which one was Sanctuary?
That was the one with the aliens that came through the wormhole, and they thought that Bajor was their homeland.
Oh yeah,
and all that kind of stuff, right? And I think that it's particularly relevant to this episode, so I'll just read a little bit of it, where he says, "This meaning." The kind of the failure of DS9 to really grapple with the Federation, which I think is actually not true, but you know, whatever. He says this is particularly apparent not only in the failure of diplomacy or solidarity, but in the way the material conditions of the Federation and Bajor are treated. There's a famine on Bajor. What's the Federation doing? The technology we see every day in this post-scarcity civilization should easily make famines a thing of the past, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I respond to this comment, and I think that I want to raise it on the show because I think that the thing about it is that that he's forgetting is that Bajor has had a very tenuous relationship with the Federation. And, you know, at the beginning of the season, the government was almost taken over in a coup by a xenophobic organization that wanted to kick the Federation out. You know, I don't think that the Federation is the, you know, it's, and I'm
sorry. But I guess my question is, why couldn't, you know, what would it cost the Federation? Any planet that goes up to the Federation and says, look, we are starving. Can we get a bunch of replicators?
Do we not have any indication that that's the case? I mean, you know, certainly if they don't have replicator technology, the Federation isn't just going to give it to them. But I don't think that there's any evidence that the Federation wouldn't help a planet that was having a famine and came to Starfleet.
Yeah, well,
and I think that's the difference.
Well, then that's the thing. I mean, Bajor wants to retain its sovereignty, and, you know, in this situation, you know, what you're implying is that, you know, you need to be completely a Federation, you know, planet for
us to
help you.
No, that's not what I'm implying at all. I'm saying that if a planet says, hey, we don't want your help, the Federation's going to go, all right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that if Bajor, you know, came to them tomorrow and said, hey, you know, give us food, they'd be like, all right. You know, and but again, I'm tying this into the conversation where Sisko and Kira have that heated conversation in Sisko's office where Kira says that the Federation, you know, she thinks that the Federation is even more naive than she already thinks it is, because the Federation, you know, is the Federation naive? I think that's the question at the heart of this episode. You know, the Federation has always been portrayed as an entity, and Starfleet has always been portrayed as an entity that believes in the fundamental decency of everybody.
Yeah.
And is very respectful of life. I think I've said in the past, and I think that you've agreed with this, that Star Trek is a franchise that believes in the existence of good, but does not believe in the existence of evil.
Yes.
I think that Deep Space Nine is making a strong case for the existence of evil so far. And it's the show that is putting its own stamp on this. Now, what does Kira mean when she says that the Federation is naive?
And this is going back with, you know, in general, you know, the Federation can't understand somebody who wants to stay on their own planet. And they also I think we can put money on the Cardassians, who are living in Federation territories, are pretty much ignored. You know, they're not bothered by anybody. You know, Federation doesn't try to make life harder for them. You know, maybe they're a little more hands off. Maybe they wouldn't actually give assistance the way a Federation colony giving a distress call, they wouldn't give that. But they're leaving them alone, and so the Federation has a blindness to the fact that the Cardassians might not treat Federation citizens the same way. You know, the Federation thinks they're living by the golden rule and everybody else is too.
Well, I think that's exactly what the point is. And I think that, you know, that's really astute, because I think that is why Kira says that she thinks the Federation is naive.
From her view, you're living under Cardassian occupation, which she did live, you know, and which the Federation colonists in Cardassian space are living that way. You're going to want to have a gun because, you know, things are going to be very tough for you and you're going to need to protect yourself. And so she, you know, she sees this as a powder keg ready to go off. Yeah, of course they're going to want weapons. And of course that, you know, that's going to escalate. And, you know, she sees it as a major clusterfuck. The Federation thinks, well, this is going to be fine. We're not going to do anything. Why would they do anything?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, the Federation, you know, not to put, you know, too many spoilers in place, but I think that, you know, maybe you can see that Deep Space Nine is going to be the Star Trek show that starts to have that be questioned a little bit, or have that be tested a little bit.
Well,
you know,
there is
a very real inference so far that the Federation has had it very easy. You know, and certainly in the original series, they had border skirmishes with the Klingons and the Romulans, and they, you know, it's not as though the Federation has never had enemies. But I think that the Federation has always thought that they can make their enemies their friends, and so far they've been able to, at least somewhat. You know, or they've been able to sideline them to such a degree that it doesn't really matter. You know, TNG was very much, I mean, there are specific episodes that I can think of about how, you know, Picard was doing the right thing, even though it can seem to be naive in sort of respect to those beliefs and ideals. And I think that what you're seeing is someone like Kira who is looking at that point of view and saying, you people are nuts.
Yeah.
You know,
there's the sense that the Federation, at least in the original series and, you know, to a lesser degree, Next Generation was America. And you have at this point, America's starting to lose its superpower status. And so, you know, and realize that, you know, no, it, you know, maybe, you know, years ago, you know, you show up, you know, you're this big, powerful country. We can get everything done. The Federation, no one's going to stop the Federation. You know, we're such good people that, you know, and we've got, you know, such technology that everybody's going to want to join our club. And now they're meeting people who don't want to join their club and who want to, frankly, destroy the clubhouse, and they don't get it. And that, you know, and this isn't even a situation like the Borg is even more comprehensible than, you know, what's going on with this dumb treaty. I mean, they make it very clear that this was a stupid treaty that they made, and it is a stupid treaty.
Right, because, you know, the Federation, again, as you said, thinks that the Cardassians are going to be as nice to their colonists as the Federation is being to the Cardassian colonists, and that's not the case.
The treaty is the seeds of the Maquis. I mean, that's what led – it's what created the Maquis in a way.
Yeah,
or the need for the Maquis, let's say.
And I think it's funny because I think that the argument you could make about this first part of the two-parter is that the Federation, this is the beginning of the Federation and Starfleet learning that the sort of top-down belief that everybody is acting in good faith kind of hurts the people at the bottom sometimes. And they're the ones – if the Federation believes that the Cardassians are acting in good faith and they make this treaty and the Cardassians are not acting in good faith, the Federation isn't going to suffer. These people are going to suffer. And so
and frankly, there's a little bit where the Federation gets to wash its hands of it by saying, well, they had the choice.
Yeah.
We gave them a choice. You know, it sucks that they're in this terrible situation, but they had a choice. You know, I mean, Sisko openly says that a couple times.
Which for an organization which Kira and the show seems to think is a little naive is extremely cynical. You know, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that reading of it, but I think that there is an inference of that at least.
Yeah. Again, it's either so cynical that it makes the or it's so naive in a way. You know, it says that they have freedom to the degree that, you know, well, I could choose whether to, you know, I could go on a hunger strike, and if I starve to death, it's my fault because I could have eaten, you know. But
it is possible. You know, I don't agree that the Federation is naive. You know, I don't know if you do, but what I think you're seeing here is the Federation thinking that the solutions of the past are going to work now.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the Cardassian demilitarized zone is a kind of a direct analog to the, you know, Klingon and Romulan neutral zones from the original series. And there's no interpretation where you could assume that there were Federation colonies in the neutral zone.
Yeah.
Like, and so the Federation seems to be maybe a little bit more with it 100 years ago than they are now.
Yeah.
You know, and so they think that, well, we did this once or twice. It's going to work with the Cardassians. Well, they have some colonies there. Well, we'll just leave them there and it'll be fine because it's always been fine. But you know what? It might not be fine. And I think this episode is saying, hey, guys, this isn't fine.
I mean, I'm thinking about how the Klingons and the Federation finally developed whatever alliance they have, you know, require nearly the complete destruction of the Klingon Empire, you know, through because of a disaster.
Sure, yeah.
To where they needed to go to the Federation, which was the closest nice superpower that would take them in, and that eventually led to, you know, that was the events of Star Trek VI. I don't think Cardassia would have a disaster along those lines and would go to the Federation for help, and so that solution's not going to work this time, you know. It's very clear that the Cardassians are very patient and very willing to play the long game, and so, you know, they're just waiting for, you know, their next advantage, you know. And
well, I think all I can say about that is stay tuned.
Okay.
Because of course, again, you have a good read on where their show may be going.
Yeah. Yay.
What do you? I mean, we haven't talked a lot about the actual Maquis, and I think that There's not a lot to talk about. I think that it
not
is
quite yet.
It is a lot of surface. I think that, you know, obviously the second part of this two-parter is, you know, seems to be going in the direction of dealing with the Maquis a lot more explicitly, you know, with the revelation that Cal, for example, is part of the Maquis,
which reminded me of the Circle reveal, of course.
Yeah, a little bit. And I don't know that it, I mean, were you surprised by that?
Yes and no. I can't say that the question of, well, who's the Maquis leader was very big in my mind in this episode. That wasn't quite the question that it was having me ask, you know? And again, knowing that I knew basically what the Maquis was.
And also, I don't know that it's the right interpretation that he's the leader. I mean,
well,
you know. He's working with them, but I don't know that I would say that he's the leader.
I wasn't shocked that most of the people we met in this episode turned out to be Maquis. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, what you could say about that is individual people in Starfleet, you know, we're starting to get at the edges of differences in opinion turning into serious conflict.
I mean, it's making
in the way that the Next Generation never did. You know, if Picard was the liaison officer in these planets, there's no way that he would ever join with the Maquis.
But again, you know, given how Ensign Rose's story ended with, you know, the fact that, you know, at that point, that episode paints the Maquis as extremist and violent, but maybe not wrong, you know, and it certainly makes it that you can't, you know, again, it's dealing with that line between freedom fighter and terrorist. And I think that, you know, the Ensign Rose episode goes a little far out of its way in a good way to paint the Maquis as neutral. But I think at this point, since all we see of them are, you know, a group that's attacking ships, we need to have, frankly, somebody that Sisko knows and trusts in order to give them a bit of that credibility, because the Maquis do need that credibility to the degree that we can't completely say they're wrong quite yet. You know, we need to at least understand that if they're doing the wrong thing, it's for some damn good reasons.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think at the end of the day, too, yeah, you have Sisko, who was put in a no-win situation, really. And on the one hand, these colonists are being harassed by the Cardassians, and I don't think that Sisko doesn't believe that that's happening.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Sisko does have a legitimate point that this treaty is necessary to avoid another war with Cardassia.
I think what Sisko would have, you know, if you had asked Sisko before the events of this episode, you know, what would be the ideal way to solve this? Well, hopefully the Federation will just eventually realize that, you know, they need to come back into Federation space, you know, I think that's what, you know, it seems like most of the Federation assume that, well, we'll let them stew a couple years, you know, and eventually they'll, you know, come back, you know, home, and they'll feel bad, you know, and it'll be okay, and we'll give them whatever they need. And while they've been waiting for this happening, you know, again, an armed resistance group has formed.
Yeah, and they're blowing things up on Federation property now.
Yeah.
Or are they?
Well,
I mean, you've got that whole subplot with Quark and the arms dealer, which we haven't even talked about, which, you know, is fine for what it is. But obviously there's a lot more going on around the edges than I think the show has shown us so far. And I think that it's interesting that it's doing that.
Yeah. Good for it.
I guess we'll just have to find out what happens in the Maquis part two.
Ooh, part two.
But before we do that, I want to do something a little strange that we don't really do that often and comment on some current events. I've been actually weighing whether or not I want to do this. And a couple months ago, Jennifer Lean, who played Cass on Star Trek Voyager, got arrested. And she is someone that has had some life problems in the past few years. You know, Richard doesn't know who she is because we have not gotten to Star Trek Voyager yet.
Did she play Tuvok?
She played Cass. I said that.
Is Cass Tuvok?
Yes, Cass is Tuvok.
Wow, she played Tuvok.
Yeah, she did. She apparently, as I understand it, exposed herself to a child. We don't know what the details are. And there was a lot of ugliness from some Star Trek fans online that I do not appreciate. And I think that all I want to say about it is Jennifer Lean is obviously a troubled person. We don't know what's going on with her. Please stop the armchair quarterbacking and all of the speculation about what is wrong with her, especially all of the sort of sexist stuff about what she looks like now, because frankly, that's irrelevant. This is a person who sounds like they're in a lot of pain, and we should respect that.
And that's not all I'm just say in about Jennifer that. Lean, but in each other.
Yeah.
But let's give it to Jennifer Lean too.
Yes.
Respect.
Now, if you would like to agree or disagree with anything about this episode of Trekabout, please leave a comment on the post for this episode, like Jonas Karatzis, who is a Greek man, at trekaboutshow.com. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Username is trekaboutshow. Do you see a pattern here? And as always, leave us a positive 5-star iTunes review.
What's the username for that?
There is no username. It's an iTunes review.
I never did it.
You shouldn't review the show. That would be wildly inappropriate.
I'm wildly inappropriate.
Yeah, I know. You're not wearing pants.
No, I'm wearing shorts.
Anyway, next week, we are going to wrap up the two-parter with The Maquis Part 2 and The Wire.
Oh, I love that show.
It's, yeah, we have to watch 5 seasons of The Wire tomorrow.
It'll be a nice little side diversion.
All right, so we'll talk to you then.